So this evening I'm going to be speaking about right view and how that fits into the Buddhist path and what it is and how it fits in there and what supports it and all that kind of thing. So the Buddha, one of his first teachings, or perhaps essentially his first teaching, is there audio? There's no audio.
Is this better? A little better? A little better? No? Nothing? No. Yes, now you can hear something. Okay.
You can't hear anything, Lucia. Can you?
I hear you, but I hear something.
You hear me, but you don't hear anything coming out of the speakers. Anybody else?
Coming out of the speaker.
Okay. Okay. I'll speak loud. Okay. So the Buddha's first teaching was the Four Noble Truths. People have heard of the Four Noble Truths before, even if you don't know them. Okay, even if you don't, that's okay. So with the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha explains that there is stress or unsatisfactoriness or suffering in the world. Basically, he said there's this thing called dukkha. And dukkha can be translated in all these different ways, right? And that this is inextricably interwoven with our experience. We're just kind of, to some extent, we're stuck. It's part of the bargain. If we take human birth, or if we take birth as a living being, we're going to experience dukkha on some level, yeah? Physical discomfort, emotional pain. Anybody ever had emotional pain? Yeah? Okay. Yeah, all that kind of stuff. And he also said that there's a way that we get stuck with that. And that a way that we really contribute to this dukkha for ourselves. And that's because we tend to, with the things that we like, we want them to stick around. We want them to stay, get bigger, last longer. Right. And there's certain things that we dislike, and we want those to go away. You know, with either way, we want to feel good. We want to always feel good, but that's not possible. Just is not part of the bargain. Just it isn't going to turn out that way. In case you had not read ahead to the ending, this is the spoiler alert. It's not going to turn out. That pleasant stuff is going to go away. So those are the first two noble truths, that there is dukkha and that dukkha has a cause. And there is also some good news. And that is that the first part of the good news is that there is the end of suffering is possible. The cessation, the end of it, is possible. And that we can know it. Not bad, yeah? Okay. And there is some more good news as well. And that is that the Buddha taught that there is a way to get there. There's a way to get to the end. That is the fourth noble truth. That path, that noble eightfold path, that path to the end of suffering, to the end of dukkha, consists of, as the name says, eight factors there. But they're kind of in three groupings, or three khandhas, three aggregates, whatever you want to call them, three buckets. The first part is about paying attention to how we're acting in the world. Yeah? How we talk to other people, how we're physically acting, how we make a living, how we treat others, how we engage with sexuality and sensuality in our lives. And that as we clarify this, as we get clear about how we're acting, in essence, this is really about kind of that we get to. One teacher, a monastic who lives outside of San Diego, Ajahn Tanisaro, argues that this is that we're building a skill, that we're learning skill building. That this is just the same as learning to play the piano, learning a new language, learning geography, learning to walk. That this is about building a skill. And there's a feedback loop all the time happening. So we start to take action in the world. We're always taking action. When I say action, we're walking this way and that way. We're interacting with people. We're writing emails. We're talking to people. Yeah? All of these kinds of things. So as Ajahn Tanasaro says, this is a skill. We're learning a skill. And we can use this feedback loop to see what's wholesome or skillful and what's unwholesome or unskillful. Does that make sense? Yeah?
Okay.
Over a period of time, we have less and less reason to worry about our actions. Our actions cause us, they're less troubling to us. We don't sit down to meditate, and we are just caught up in thinking about that argument that we just had, because over time, we've learned to have arguments less. We've learned that me always being right doesn't matter. You know, oh boy, that's just how I get caught there. I always want to be right. I certainly always want to be right. Don't know about you. Some of you have that, some of you don't. But over time, this starts to become less of an issue, and the mind and heart start to quiet down. This is by paying attention to how we're acting in the world. This is really a good clue that this is something we could pay very close attention to. And we can actually, over time, become very refined in how we're paying attention to this. Our heart and mind start to settle down. We have a greater sense of peace and ease. And then comes the second part, the second aggregate or bundle or grouping of these factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. And with our minds and hearts starting to quiet down, they're more calm and at ease when we start to meditate. When we actually start the formal part of the practice, the mind is more at ease, more calm, more peaceful. We're paying attention to the breath, and all of a sudden the breath just seemed like it was totally neutral for all that time. And then all of a sudden the breath starts to become quite pleasant. Or we start to do the loving kindness practice, and whereas it's come in fits and starts before, all of a sudden now it's really, there's really this feeling in the heart that generates, it just arises quite naturally, quite spontaneously. Here in the West, in my experience, I think we generally try to skip over the part of paying attention to our actions, paying attention to ethical conduct, to how we're acting in the world and interacting with others. And we try to go right to the good stuff, yeah? Give me the meditation. I want the good stuff. I don't need to do that. I'm not killing anybody here, so just give me the real stuff, and I'll get to work. But there really isn't a good way to skip it. When we do that, we sit down to meditate, and we're totally agitated, and all the kind of mind's racing this way and that. We're consumed with how this person screwed us over. How could they do that? And how we're going to get back at them, and fantasizing and replaying the situation multiple times and rehearsing how we're going to get back at them. Has anybody ever done this before? Yeah? Okay. A little bit. But if we have paid closer and closer attention to our behavior, the mind starts to collect and unify more readily in meditation. We can direct it more easily. We can actually kind of point it in a direction, and it's like a well-trained hunting dog or something. It's like we say go and it points, it's like, oh, wow, it's really something. We can direct the attention more easily. The power of our ability to investigate is stronger. We can stay with something for longer, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. We have that ability. Yeah? Deeper insights start to arise just on their own, without us forcing anything. What we've done is we've cultivated the garden, yeah? And now we've planted these seeds and we watered them and we pulled up some of these weeds in there. And because there's some warm sun, and we planted it in a place where there's warmth, And we planted the right kind of seeds at the right time of year. We've learned over time, when we planted those tomato seeds in October, it didn't work out so great for us as it's starting to get colder. But the next year we learned, oh, plant those in April, May. That's the time to do that around here. Yeah. Deeper insights start to arise, which feed our progress on the path. During the time, I spent some time in Burma doing practice there, and my initial response was, if you ask me right after I got back, was that the experience had been really disappointing. I had wanted these meditative insights to come, and I didn't get them. Well, disappointment in practice, yeah. At the time, I wasn't particularly good at dealing with that. What I missed at the moment, but was got hit in the face with over and over, was all of these powerful insights that I'd had about our behavior and just how powerful it is to pay attention to that really closely. The subtle, mind and heart getting more and more subtle about subtle ways. Am I causing harm with this action or not? Am I? Oh, well, there is maybe this... It's a little bit of this cavalier attitude towards it. This kind of screw it, they're just ants attitude. Oh, I don't need to. Oh, well, what if I wanted that differently? What if that's. And then starting to feel the pain of that, you know, not the guilt. It wasn't guilt there. Guilt is not particularly useful. I recommend against guilt. It's part of our human experience. We get it, it arises, but I wouldn't cultivate that. But as I was paying very fine attention to not taking life, even of the bugs, you know, mosquitoes, there were a lot of mosquitoes there. I brushed them off, you know, but I wouldn't slap them. I wouldn't try to kill them. It was quite magical how much my mind settled down. My mind had been so agitated initially, and it just really started to settle down. So I think a lot of times people tend to pay attention to the precepts only when they're on retreat. But this is not just I think we're really discarding what's an incredibly powerful and valuable teaching. Incredibly valuable and powerful practice, if we want to use that. Because with this, then we can, it really does serve that formal meditation practice, the stilling of the mind. So when we gather here on Sunday evenings, sitting in the group together, the mind naturally gets more still. Yeah. So, and then as these insights start to arise, sometimes initially they can be insights about our own history. Do this, you know. I always did that. What is that about? And we start to really see that, how we're just conditioned. We've been conditioned to respond or to react, really, in this one way. Yeah. Over time, these insights become more impersonal in nature. We're seeing less about ourselves and what we did and how I always interact with my brothers this way. And just seeing like the impersonal nature of experience as it arises, we see how we're taking it personally and we latch on and do that. We start to really see the impermanent nature of experience. Or we start to see the unsatisfactory nature of experience, the insubstantial nature of experience. Yeah. All these things, we just start to see these over and over. We've been tending the garden skillfully over a period of time. And we're starting to reap these benefits. This is the third part of the path. The third bucket or grouping or aggregate, however you want to call it. This is the wisdom grouping. There's the sila grouping, which is the ethical conduct or behavior. There's the samadhi grouping, which is the collecting and unifying the mind. Sitting meditation, walking meditation. And now this is the third grouping, the wisdom grouping, panya. These insights lead to stronger and stronger wisdom. And we can gain some measure of wisdom from listening to things, yeah? From listening to things. We hear a Dharma talk, and that a Dharma talk from a teacher, and we feel like it really speaks to us. Yeah, we read a book, we download a talk on the internet or something, and that really, we really get that. We really hear something, we read this thing, and it really, it impacts us in some way. It's an important method of learning. And then, yet there's also this way of developing insights, as Philip has talked about. We get these insights for ourselves, yeah? This is the level of our own knowing. Yeah. And over time, we start to penetrate experience more. This arising and passing, the insubstantial nature, the unsatisfactory nature of experience. Now, it's not... While I did speak of this in a somewhat linear fashion, there's a little bit of linearity to it. There is generally, when we talk about these three groupings, these three aggregates in the Eight Noble Eightfold Path, they're spoken of as sila, samadhi, and punya. So ethical conduct, the collecting and unifying of the mind or concentration, and then wisdom, punya, wisdom. Our right view is actually the first factor on the path, right view and right intention. These are wisdom factors. They're the first ones on the path. We need some measure of them to get started. Yeah. In general, in our lives, for most of us, we've had some experience of dukkha, that unsatisfactoriness, that suffering. We don't know that word at all, but, you know, could be some people are alcoholics, some people are workaholics. We have relationships that leave us in a lot of pain. We practice in some other tradition, and our teacher does something, or in a church, and some leader does something, or at work, something happens to us, something in our personal life, wherever. These kinds of things. We're looking for ways to get free of this. And we've got all of our strategies, yeah? Anybody have strategies to try and avoid dukkha? Anybody not have strategies? I can tell you, I got a good artery. I've got tons of them. But at some point, we have some, there's some turning that happens in the heart and mind that kind of says, you know what? This hasn't done it for me. This next drink, this next TV show, this next argument with so-and-so, this next avoiding this experience in my life, it just isn't going to do it anymore. There's got to be another way. Yeah. Yeah, so we've all pretty much tried our favorite ways of filling up that whatever that challenging experience for us is, that emptiness, that longing, that anger, whatever that experience is, yeah, of trying to keep away from the dukkha. Philip Moffat, our main teacher, kind of our guiding teacher here at Marin Sangha, has written a couple books, and this comes from his book, Dancing with Life. And here's, I have some quotes from here. The Buddha asks you to realize that there's a path to finding freedom from the angst of your life and experiencing more joy. Implicit is the authentic possibility that you have the power to change your inner experience of life, and there is a specific means for you to do so. Yeah. So note that Philip didn't say, talk about changing your external conditions, getting better conditions, getting that better paying job, getting that better relationship, that newer, fancier car, whatever it is. Yeah. It's not that we don't have, it's not that being in a healthy relationship is not valuable, or having means of transportation or any of those things could not be worthwhile goals in themselves. But what he's really pointing to is that we can radically change our relationship to our life on the inner level, to the conditions of our life, just as they are, without having to force them to be different, which is really what the Buddha was talking about. So there's a stock passage in the text about right view. And what bhikkhus, monastics, or serious, dedicated practitioners on the path, and what bhikkhus is right view, at least this one type of right view, there is what is given and what is offered and what is sacrificed. There is fruit and result of good and bad actions. There is this world and the other world. There is mother and father. There are beings who are reborn spontaneously. There are in the world good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins who have realized for themselves by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. This is right view. So what does that mean? Huh? Wait. I'm going to read a quote from another, from Ajahn Tamsaro, also known as Tanjev. I forgot to read my, I forgot to bring my glasses, so we'll see if I can, I think I can get this. Readers? Are they reached? Go. We'll see. Okay. Oh, yeah, they're good. Okay. Okay. What this passage means is that there is merit in generosity. Yeah. So that is, there's what is given and what is offered and sacrificed. There, and what is sacrificed. Yeah. So there is, we do, there is value in practicing generosity and giving, practicing dana. Let's see, what's the next one? There are fruits and results of good and bad actions. And his translation of that is, interpretation, the moral qualities of good and bad are inherent parts of the cosmos, and not simply social conventions. That is actually one of the truths that the Buddha was teaching about, is that these things are, that there is not, the Buddha was not teaching moral relativism. Well, it might be okay if you do this, and it might be okay if you do that. What he said is that karma, which is a translation of action, the word action, that karma is based on our intention. What is the motivation behind our action? So therefore, there is no relativism. It's not that an action won't be mixed, won't have parts good and parts bad, but that there is a difference. Okay, let's see what the next one is. There is this world and the next world. Okay. So he translates that, or explains that, paraphrases that as, there is life after death. In the Buddhist cosmology, the Buddha talked about the endless rounds of rebirth until such time as we get ourselves off the path, off the wheel. There is mother and father. What the heck does that mean, huh? Okay. He explains that, Tanasaro Bhikkhu explains that as, one has a true moral debt to one's parents. This makes sense if we think of the fact that in terms of Buddhist cosmology, there are many different realms of existence. There are the hell realms, there are the animal realms, there are the hungry ghosts, there are the angry gods, the human realm, and then the heavenly realms. Yeah. There are all these different planes within these different realms, or many of them have different planes. So if there is this round of rebirths, and as one birth ends, we go on to the other, then it's, what he's saying is that, you know, there's some acknowledgement of this. I would not recommend getting caught up in these as beliefs that you have to adopt. As a matter of fact, I would recommend against that. you may wish to investigate them and see, how does this feel? How do I feel about this? But I wouldn't get caught up in having them as set beliefs in any way. But if there, it was said that the human realm prevented the best opportunity for awakening and for practice. In the hell realms, the hungry ghost realms, it's too, the amount of dukkha is too overwhelming. You know, it's just too much. We can't bear it. There's no way to get any space there. Yeah. So it's, those aren't so great for practice. The animal realms, well, sometimes domesticated animals around here, they've got a pretty cush life. But you can still see their animal nature sometimes coming out. A friend of mine had a dog, and this friend kept his dog food bag. He kept an extra dog food bag in the closet. And one day while he was away at work, his dog broke into the closet and ate the dog food bag, 10-pound bag. And I saw the dog that evening. It had been several hours since the dog had finished eating. And his belly was, it's like, this is a top view of his looking down on him from, on his back from above. His body went like this, swelled way out, went like this. He couldn't sit down. He was too full. And he was just whimpering and kind of walking in the slow pacing of standing still. And he did that throughout the night. Okay? Animal realm? That's the animal realm right there. Okay? That's some measure of the animal realm. So this mother and father thing. In the heavenly realms, it's almost all pleasant. Yeah? There's this much dukkha, and there's this much sukha, or pleasant experience. Where's the motivation to practice in that? You would have to have a very clear seeing to be able to get there. Yeah. The human birth, by contrast, holds the possibility of a better balancing of the dukkha and the sukha. The suffering, the unsatisfactoriness, and the pleasant experience. So we have these. Now, these realms of existence may actually exist, and we may actually be reborn into them and out of them. I have no idea. However, many of us have known something like a hell realm in this existence, or have known somebody who was in one. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Yeah? And many of us have also known something like a heavenly realm in this existence. Yeah? I'm not saying it lasted long. It may have been quite brief. Both of them may have been quite brief. So this human existence offers the opportunity, the best opportunity, for practice on the path. The dukkha is less likely to be completely overwhelming. Yeah? The sukha less likely to be completely overwhelming. With that being the case, these beings who brought us into this existence said that we owe them a debt. That's what the Buddha said. You see for yourselves, if that makes sense for you. I'm not saying you have to have your parents be your best friends. Not saying that at all. Okay. Let's continue on here. Okay. And then there are priests and contemplatives who, faring rightly and practicing rightly, proclaim this world and the next after having directly known and realized it for themselves. And his transliteration of that is, there are people who have lived the renunciate's life, lived as a monastic in some way, properly, in such a way that they have gained true and direct knowledge of these matters. Yeah. Okay. So, one of the things at the center of this, again quoting from Dancing with Life, is that quote, "Your thoughts, words, and actions have consequences. They condition future moments in your life that will create either suffering or non-suffering." Does that make sense? A famous American monastic, another famous American monastic, Bhikkhu Bodhi, said that to understand kamma, another translation of karma or action, we have to understand the ethical distinction into wholesome and unwholesome, the main types of each and the roots. In other words, we need to see that, and so these are the unwholesome actions. Let's see if I have the list here. And this comes from one of the discourses of the Buddha. And what, friends, is the unwholesome? What is the root of the unwholesome? Killing living beings is unwholesome. Taking what is not given is unwholesome. Misconduct in sensual pleasures is unwholesome. Those first three are physical actions, yeah, that we'll take. The next four are verbal. False speech is unwholesome. Malicious speech is unwholesome. Harsh speech is unwholesome. Gossip is unwholesome. Or idle chatter is unwholesome. Okay, those are the unwholesome forms of speech. And then there are the three unwholesome mind states. Covetousness is unwholesome. Greed. Ill will is unwholesome. Wrong view is unwholesome. And what is the root of the unwholesome? Greed is a root of the unwholesome. Yeah? Hate is a root of the unwholesome. Delusion is a root of the unwholesome. These are called the roots of the unwholesome. Those are the unwholesome. There are also the wholesome actions, the 10 wholesome actions, groupings of wholesome actions. They're pretty much the corollaries here. And what is the wholesome? Abstention. Abstaining from killing living beings is wholesome. Abstention from taking what is not given is wholesome. Abstention from misconduct and sensual pleasures is wholesome. Abstention from false speech is wholesome. Abstention from malicious speech is wholesome. Abstention from harsh speech is wholesome. Abstention from gossip is wholesome. Those are your speeches, the mind states. Uncovetousness is wholesome. Non-ill will is wholesome. Right view is wholesome. This is called the wholesome. And the roots there are non-greed, which would be generosity. Non-ill will, which would be compassion and goodwill. And non-delusion, which would be wisdom. Yeah. So we can start to use these as ways to look at our actions a little bit more closely. I did see in one discourse that there are five factors that assist right view. Yeah. Yet another list. We're going into one more list here. Okay. It's a great list. The list is the factors that assist right view are virtue. In other words, skillful action, right? That's how we get to virtue. Learning, discussion. You don't see that often in the list. Learning and discussion, serenity and insight. So, going from this Dharma talk, from another Dharma talk, from a chapter in a book that you're reading, talking about that with a friend, about how that might impact your practice. These are supports for right view. These assist you in developing right view and deepening your experience with that. I have a cartoon from the New Yorker, and it shows this. It's in this dojo, and this is martial arts teacher, and he's standing there, and he's got his three students sitting there on the floor, and he's standing there, and he's got the American flag in the background, and then some kind of Asian languaging tapestry hanging on the wall, And then you see these two cinder blocks with a slat over them. Yeah? Anybody ever seen those practices where they break things? Okay. And he's teaching them their next lesson. Now, suppose some guy comes at you balanced between two blocks. This is how we start. We start with the artificial conditions. I don't think, unlike this martial arts teacher, I don't think that's really the, we don't have to pretend that this is the person, you know, coming at us this way, you know? It's kind of ludicrous, but that's the humor in that, right? But we start with the easy stuff. We start with somewhat artificial conditions. There's another monastic who I've heard, and I can't remember exactly which one it was, who says, coming here, this is not practice, this is preparation. Out there is practice. In our daily lives, going to work, being in traffic, dealing with our partner about who takes out the garbage, whose turn is it to wash the dishes, or why are you so crabby right now? You know, that is practice. This is the preparation. Yeah. Bruce Lee, the martial art expert, actually, you know, I never actually saw any of his movies. Did anybody see any Bruce Lee movies? Yeah? Okay. Oh, okay. We got some. Well, we could do a Bruce Lee film festival here, it looks like. Yeah, okay. So I never saw any of his movies, and I always kind of dismissed him. Look, he's just some martial arts guy. This quote, Wendy Palmer, who's been here, I think I heard this quote from her, and it's probably not a quote at this point, it's probably more like a paraphrasing, because I don't think I got it exactly. But essentially he said, in crisis, we don't rise to the level of our expectations, we fall to the level of our training. Yeah? That's the truth. Yeah? That's why we practice. The Buddha was not, in my experience, he was not a philosopher. He didn't care about philosophy. He didn't want people to, he didn't care about metaphysics. He was a scientist of the mind. And of how can we get free, completely free? Another way, I may have a little bit more than I have time for. So one other thing that I want to mention is that another way to look at right view, another classical teaching of right view, is the Four Noble Truths themselves. Seeing suffering, the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering, the Four Noble Truths. Likewise, another great way to work with right view. So to work with this, you're caught in traffic. You're in an argument at work. You see that cake on the table. Whatever it is. What is the felt sense of the experience in the body? You know, you're sitting in traffic, you're pissed off. What's the felt sense of being pissed off right in that moment? What is it like? You can be mindful with your eyes open. What is it like when we're agitated and we're trying to get something? What's the felt sense like in the body? What is the mind like? Is judging or comparing or fixing present? You're doing this just to notice what's true, not to judge, compare, and fix yourself. Yeah? Just, oh yes, judging is here. Oh, judging again. Yep, how many times a day? Many. Okay, this is one of them. So over time, you know, a small child, they have to learn not to touch the flame on a stove, that it'll burn them. But over time, we don't need somebody to tell us. We don't need to remind ourselves. We see the flame, our hand, if it gets too close, it gets hot, we pull away. Yeah? We can develop similar responsiveness around skillful action. We have this opportunity to really investigate this. Is this action leading to suffering? Right now, am I suffering or am I not suffering? is this action? If I say this now, is this going to lead to suffering or to the end of suffering? We can start to cultivate this in ourselves over time. So we've done something a few times in here that seems to have been a positive thing, and that is to break out into small groups. So I want to do that this evening and take maybe 10 minutes. First, I'll tell you, discuss what your understanding is of right view or something in the talk that you heard that you may be interested in practicing with for a bit, something like that. The most important thing is that you discuss something around right view, okay? Don't get caught up in getting it exactly right. So why don't we get into groups of, say, three to four people, and you have to manage the time inside of that 10-minute period on your own, and then I'll ring the bell at the end of 10 minutes, okay? And as maybe a stretch, if you're up for it, get together some people you haven't gotten together with before. Thank you.